Welcome to Stock Stories, episode 102. All right. Welcome. This is the Stock Stories Podcast. My name is Alex, and I am your host and stock storyteller for today. Thank you so much for joining me. And if you're new to the show, Stock Stories is the podcast dedicated to helping you, the individual investor, make better investing decisions. And we primarily do that by looking at case studies of real companies. We try to look at what's actually going on out there in the stock market and the world, as well as look at mental models of how to better make philosophically based decisions. So we combine the practical side with the philosophical side, and that's what we do here on this show. So I'm ready to go back into the S&P 500 companies. I don't know about you. So we got another company for you today. And this company is a financial company. It's been a while since we studied a financial. So this one was suggested by Felix from Germany. Felix, thank you if you're listening for the suggestion. And so without further ado, let's just get right into it. Today, let's talk about BlackRock. All right, so BlackRock Financial is a asset manager. And in fact, instead of just being a typical asset manager, it is the largest asset manager in the world. By the time I record this, or as I record this, they manage somewhere around $7 trillion. $7 trillion, that's incredible. There's nobody really who comes close. There's the big three within the industry. There's BlackRock, there's Vanguard, and then there's State Street. But BlackRock is the biggest. And so they manage more assets in the world than anyone else, really. And that has some interesting implications, which we'll discuss in a moment. But where did this company come from? You know, on this show, we always like to start with, where did the company begin? Well, what's the historical context? So BlackRock is ticker symbol BLK, and it was actually founded as Blackstone Financial by several people, Larry Fink, Rob Capito, Susan Wagner, and several others. So it was all these different asset managers got together and formed this company, Blackstone Financial, in 1988. So this is a relatively young company. It's not a company that's been around for ages and ages like a JP Morgan or Wells Fargo or American Express. It's pretty new. And what these people decided to do was to build an asset management firm, but they wanted to focus on managing risk. Some of the original partners of Blackstone Financial first came from a company called First Boston, and they had started making some management errors with mortgage-backed securities, and that was kind of their thing. And they made some mistakes there, learned from them, and decided to create a new asset management firm. And their focus first was on trading mortgage and other fixed income securities. So when I say fixed income securities, I'm talking about bonds, right? And similar types of securities. So that's how they got their start. And the main leader of this group was Larry Fink. So Fink got funding from a private equity firm. So remember, a private equity firm is a company that invests in private businesses instead of public ones like on the stock market. So he got funding from this private equity firm, the Blackstone Group, which is to this day the largest alternative asset manager in the world. And he got $5 million in a credit line in exchange for 50% of the bond side of the business. So basically, they were getting backed by this well-established financial company in order to start a different company. And Blackstone's stake went from 50% down to 40% over time because of equity offerings to new employees as the team grew. So Blackstone Financial started managing assets, started managing fixed income securities and mortgage securities. And as they would bring on new employees, they would give them stock. And so naturally that dilutes the previous owners a little bit. It's also an interesting kind of a deal because Larry Fink got a 2.5% interest in the parent company, Blackstone. So they're kind of like different entities and different people trading ownership in order to make deals happen. So naturally, Blackstone Financial wanted to limit their risk in this new venture, but also they wanted to give some incentive to the people who were starting this new venture. So you have some interesting deal terms there. So at the time, as it was known, Blackstone Financial, they started innovating in a variety of different financial products. So they had a Blackstone Term Trust, which by itself raised over $1 billion in capital. They also started offering closed-end funds, defined contribution plans, etc. And I won't get into the definitions of what all of these different financial products are, but needless to say, there's a lot of different types of financial products out there. And even in the early days, BlackRock was involved with selling them, putting them together, selling them to institutional clients, selling them to retail clients. And the thing was, it was founded by some experienced asset managers and people who were already in the business. And they really wanted to create a mammoth financial company. And that's exactly what they set out to do. So in 1992, they ended up changing their name to BlackRock. Now, when I was doing research for this company, I just had to like kind of separate it in my mind because it's kind of confusing, like BlackRock and Blackstone, you got different entities. But the company we're discussing today is BlackRock. So the CEO of Blackstone Group, see, it's kind of confusing, right? Blackstone Group, the original company, the private equity company, his name is or was Steve Schwarzman. And so Steve and Larry kind of disagreed about the equity and the compensation in the business. So basically, they started parting ways. In 1994, the mortgage securities part of BlackRock was sold off to PNC Bank. PNC Bank is a large bank here in the United States. So access to PNC, it was important because now the company was able to move into other types of products. They were able to move into equities, open-ended mutual funds, and other types of products. So now they have this connection with this large bank. They started out with this connection with a large alternative asset manager, and now they kind of pivoted to having more of a connection with this traditional bank. And so they were able to get more products out there, expand their product line. And BlackRock became a standalone company in 1999, and that is the year it had its initial public offering on the New York Stock Exchange. So at the time, already they managed $165 billion. That's huge, all right? Like, as an asset manager, especially back in the late 90s, that's already a ton of money under management. So you can see that the biggest player, one of the biggest players, just continued to get bigger and bigger. And throughout the 2000s, the deal making continues. They bought State Street Research and Management. And in 2006, they merged with Merrill Lynch Investment Managers, so another acquisition. And then they bought Barclays Global Investors. And the thing that's important about this last acquisition is that as part of them buying Barclays, they got a set of products called iShares. And the iShares were really important because to this day, they make up a pretty substantial part of their assets under management and thus their revenue. And we'll talk more about product mix in a second. But they grew and grew and grew. And so once a company gets to a certain size of earnings and market capitalization, and it has a track record of making profits, it tends to get added to the S&P 500. So in 2011, it was added to the S&P 500, and assets under management just grew and grew and grew, to the point where in 2012, they had almost $4 trillion under management. And then now in early 2020, as I'm recording this, they have almost $7 trillion under management. Incredible growth, especially when you consider the stock market bull run that's been going on for the past decade. And asset managers have benefited, right? Especially if they've been heavily involved in equities, which make up a pretty good chunk of the assets that BlackRock manages. So on to the business itself today. Where are we at today? Well, BlackRock is a full-service asset manager that they're saying is that they have a product for every investor. They sell passive products, active products. They sell ETFs. They sell illiquid and alternative investments. They have hedge funds, et cetera, et cetera. So naturally, as you might imagine, being the largest asset manager in the world, they pretty much have everything to pick from. So whether you're an institutional investor trying to manage a pension fund for firefighters in your local county, or you are an individual person in your 401k and you're trying to invest there, BlackRock has a product that was designed to cater to you. But actually, this product focus is something that BlackRock management has been trying to get away from in recent years. Management, in some of the reports, the leadership talks about how they don't want to be product focused. They want to be portfolio focused. Their belief is that when people are trying to design their financial lives, they're no longer necessarily picking products anymore, because there's just not a lot of differentiation between them. People are trying to basically choose allocations. They're trying to create portfolios that have a certain outcome. So this kind of coincides with some of the movements in 401ks and tax advantage accounts right now. So for a lot of employers, there's a list of options that you get, say for a 401k or an IRA at most people's workplaces. And many of these options are your typical funds, like an equity fund or a bond fund, etc. But some of these options that have been invented in recent years are like target date funds. So they're products designed for a specific outcome. So maybe a target date fund targeted at people who intend to retire in the year 2040. Okay, well, if you got 20 years until retirement, then maybe they're going to put you in a certain stock bond ratio. So maybe they'll put you 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds, or whatever. And then as you get closer to that date, say 2025 comes around, 2030 comes around, 2035 comes around, the asset allocation shifts over time and theoretically gets more conservative, and the bond allocation increases and the stock allocation decreases. So that's just an example of a type of product that is designed based on a specific outcome and is more so focused around allocation. The investor in this situation probably doesn't really care whether that equity allocation in their portfolio is an ETF from Vanguard or an iShare from BlackRock or an ETF from Invesco. They just care that equity portion is low cost and is representative of whatever types of equities that they're trying to be invested in, right? At the end of the day. So the point I'm trying to make is that BlackRock's management is recognizing this change in the asset management industry and the fact that people are more product agnostic than they've ever been. They don't really care that much about a specific brand name per se. They want an outcome. Give me a portfolio, design me a portfolio that's low cost, that's reasonable, that has a good allocation, that will get me where I want to go. And I think that's that's pretty wise that they have recognized that. And I think that there's some truth to that, especially with the massive movement into passive investment vehicles that we've seen over the past decade. It's incredible. So that is where BlackRock is more focused now, is they want to offer pretty much every kind of product that they can, because they know that investors want choice and they want to be able to have the building blocks ready for investors to have that portfolio that they're looking for. So that's the fundamental business model. They're an asset manager, and there's also other parts of their business, which I'll mention in a second. So one interesting thing about the ownership of BlackRock is that PNC Bank still owns a significant portion of BlackRock stock. They actually own 22% of BlackRock. And Vanguard is the second largest shareholder. They own a little over 5.5%. The reason I point this out is just because it's interesting in doing some of the research. The big asset managers, so BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, because they are so big now and because index funds are so big and ETFs are so big, say for your typical corporation or typical large corporation, they make up the highest concentration of shareholders. So chances are you pick an average S&P 500 company, your largest shareholders are going to be BlackRock and Vanguard. And that has some interesting implications, which I don't really know how to discuss all of it right now, but suffice it to say, things get kind of weird, right? Because you have so much power concentrated in the hands of these companies that basically have the power to potentially replace the board of directors at these companies or influence actions of management at these companies simply because they are the largest asset gatherers in the game. Like, they've got all the money in all of these funds, and most of the people who own these funds don't vote their shares. So they pretty much have a lot of power. So that's kind of an interesting implication of BlackRock, companies like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street being so huge. But I digress. So as far as BlackRock is concerned, when they acquired the iShares portfolio, it was really important because it helped maintain its massive size because of the popularity of ETFs. So the iShares are ETFs, and ETFs have become incredibly popular because they're basically like index funds, but you can trade them like a stock. You can trade them, the stock, the price of the ETF changes throughout the day, just like a stock does. Whereas an index fund, its shares only change in price, I believe, once a day. And so ETFs are kind of that next evolution of a passive investment vehicle, or for that matter, active investment vehicles. But here I'm specifically talking about index or passive types of ETFs. And another reason why ETFs are so powerful is that for BlackRock, if they want to sell a new product, say they want to invent a new ETF, all they have to do is repackage a group of securities and call it something different. Okay, done. Like, that's a bunch of paperwork and regulations that they have to abide by, but nothing physical really is happening there. They're just creating a new form of intellectual property by rearranging an ETF, right? So this is a low-cost way to grow business, and that's one of the beauties of the asset management industry, is you can literally create something out of nothing, just as an idea of a certain type of security or a reshuffling to change the type of security. So that's one thing that I find interesting about just this industry in general, and something that BlackRock has been able to do very successfully up to this point, is they can invent new ETFs, they can invent new products. So as far as the breakdown of the different asset classes that they manage, about half of their assets are in equities, about a third are in fixed income, and then the rest is in cash, multi-asset, or alternatives. And alternatives in particular is a growing sector. Now, what do I mean by alternatives? That could mean anything, right? Well, alternatives typically refer to maybe illiquid investments or just investments that are not that common. So maybe a hedge fund type of business or structure, investment structure. Maybe there's a limited partnership or some kind of infrastructure investment, like building a new power plant, and that has some kind of interesting type of security tied to it. There are all sorts of things, like investing in commodities or timberland, oil. I mean, there's a lot of different options when you start talking about alternatives. And more investors, according to, again, BlackRock management, more and more investors are saying that they want alternatives as a part of their portfolios. So that's a side of the business that BlackRock is focusing more attention on right now. Now, for the non-cash allocation of assets under management, they've got, as far as the breakdown between types of fund structures, they've got about a third in each of these three. So about a third in ETFs, so those are the iShares, a third in index funds, and a third in actively managed funds. And yes, they still do a lot of business with actively managed funds. Like, even though I've been talking about, and the industry has been talking so much about passive investment vehicles, let's not forget, active management is still alive. It's not quite dead yet. So there's still a lot of active funds out there that people have money in. So I have a feeling that during the next stock market correction, there will be at least some kind of a shift into active managed funds again. Yet again, I don't think that active management is dead per se, just because when passive strategies are working really, really well, like they have been the last several years, of course everyone's going to put money in them. Yeah, of course. But when passive strategies start to not work, at least in the short to medium term, I think we'll start to see money flow in a more balanced way between passive and active strategies, just because a lot of investors are short-term thinkers, and when the pain of a short-term loss hits their portfolio, they may say, well, I don't really want to do this passive strategy anymore. It's losing me money now. I'm going to switch to XYZ manager because they can do a better job, or they think they can do a better job. So I suspect that that allocation will continue to remain, maybe not exactly as it is now, but I think active funds will continue to exist, not just for BlackRock, but for the industry as well, as a whole. That's my feeling about it. So another interesting part about BlackRock's business is their technology services. So when you're building this asset management firm, you need a way to manage your risk. You need a way to create your financial models for different portfolios and different products. So how do you do this? Well, one thing they did many years ago, I think it was back in the 90s they invented it, is this natively grown operating system called Aladdin. And Aladdin, it basically provides premier tech solutions for the asset management industry. So you can think of it as a software tool or set of software tools that add together risk analytics, portfolio management, and trading and operations type of activities. And this is something not only specific to BlackRock. BlackRock basically grew this for themselves as their own customer and then decided to sell it to other customers, sell it to other asset managers. And the thing is, it's been doing really well for them. They grew revenue from this one segment of their business 19% from 2018 to 2019. So it's one of the higher growth sides of the business. Now, in 2018, they made just under $800 million from it in revenue, which is really great, but that's still only 5.5% of the total revenue of BlackRock. Now, I could see Aladdin getting spun off as its own company one day, just because it's growing faster than the rate of the rest of the company. And it's also really a tech offering instead of a financial-based offering. So one of the reasons it's so important is it's starting to build some brand equity within the industry. It was used by the U.S. government to value firms like Bear Stearns and AIG during the last recession. So it's been around for a little while now, and more asset managers are buying it because it meets their needs. So on to the financials of the company. So what are the financials of BlackRock look like? How do the sales grow? That's the first thing that I want to look at. So for comparison purposes, I will be referencing numbers from the year 2011 and comparing them to the year 2018. So the most recent full year data available. So in 2011, BlackRock made $9 billion in revenue, and that grew to over $14 billion. So about a 6-7% annual growth rate in sales. Not that bad, but we'll see a little bit more where that comes from. Actually, we did already talk about that. They've made a lot of acquisitions. So yeah, of course, sales are going to go up because you're buying new companies. The sales growth is not really organic growth per se, but more so an artifact of the consolidation within the industry. At least that's what I'm observing. So just keep that in mind. Yeah, they're growing sales 6-7% annually, but they're doing it by swallowing up every asset manager in their path. The net income of the business grew from just over $2 billion to over $4 billion. So about a 9% annual growth rate in net income, which is good. And then their earnings per share is even better. They went from over $12 a share to over $26 a share. And that's an over 11% growth in earnings per share. So this is great. Profits have been really growing. And management seems to have been disciplined in not letting shares get diluted so that the profits for owners has actually been going up at a decent rate. So BlackRock has been successfully going up. As far as the balance sheet is concerned, their cash position has improved. So they had over $3.5 billion in 2011, and that grew to over $6 billion. And so assets under management, they've got well over $100 billion under management. But that number has actually decreased over time, which is something that surprised me. So they had about $180 billion under management in 2011, and that shrunk to under $160 billion under management in 2018. And their liabilities have also shrunk. So $150 plus billion in liabilities has shrunk to over $125 billion. So yeah, so it seems like the business has actually shrunk a little bit, which is counterintuitive given that they acquired all these companies. But if you think about the outflows in the industry, I mean, a lot of people have just been taking their money out of the market altogether, as well as switching to lower cost vehicles. So you have these weird effects. So they've been growing in one set of the financial statements, it looks like they're growing. In another set of the financial statements, it looks like they're shrinking. But at the end of the day, they've been growing profits. One thing I do like about the balance sheet is their long-term debt has been basically unchanged for several years. So they had just under $5 billion in long-term debt in 2011, and they have just under $5 billion in long-term debt in 2018. So something good there. They've kind of kept that in check. All right. So as far as the cash flow is concerned, how did the business grow its cash? So their operating cash flow actually hasn't changed that much. It went from under $3 billion in 2011 to just about $3 billion in 2018. So that was kind of disappointing. Like, wow, they really haven't increased their cash flow that much. Maybe it's just the snapshots in time that I was looking at, but still, that's a long enough period of time you expect to see some kind of a difference. They have invested their cash mainly in acquisitions, like I mentioned, somewhere between $200 million, $800 million a year in acquisitions, depending on the opportunities. And then the financing cash that they put into the business, it is ranged. So in 2011, they invested $2.5 billion in financing cash. And then in 2018, that number was a little bit higher, but again, around the $2.5 million range. So where's that money going? I mean, they tend to split pretty evenly between share buybacks as well as dividends. So their share count has actually decreased a decent amount, which I like. They've gone from just under 190 million shares outstanding to just under 160 million shares outstanding. So they've been chipping away at that share count at about a rate of 2.5% per year, which is a solid share buyback program. As far as their dividends, they've grown their dividends. They used to pay out about $1 billion in dividends, and now it's about $2 billion. So they've grown that at a rate of about 12% a year, pretty much in line with their earnings per share growth. So that's nice to see. All right. So one thing that does confuse me a little bit about BlackRock is how they're continuing to make more money if their assets drop. I looked at the client accounts that they own. They dropped from over $118 billion in 2011 to $90 billion at the end of 2018. So how are they able to make more money? I know they've gotten more money from technology services revenue, but it must be because of their careful management of their offerings, their product mix, because they've mainly been growing through shareholder profits through successful acquisitions. And also, they've been disciplined with their returns of cash to shareholders. So that's something that I will give management, is they've been consistent with the dividends, consistent with the share buybacks. So that does impose a certain discipline on management to maintain that record. Now, the organic asset management growth of the industry is somewhere around 3%, but BlackRock can probably do a bit better than this just because of its scale. So remember, in the asset management industry, scale wins, at least for now. And BlackRock is already the top dog, and I'm sure they intend on staying at the top. So they're going to continue to try to find higher growth areas of their business that they can invest in, which, as I mentioned, one of them is the alternative assets side of the business. So where are the shares at now? So again, BlackRock trades, ticker symbol BLK. So they trade at $520 or so per share right now. And so their price earnings ratio is around 20, which for a financial company, this is actually pretty high. So I would expect BlackRock to fetch a higher multiple than its peers just because of its size and the quality of its business, but not that high. I mean, 20 is a bit high, I think, for an asset management firm, even the biggest in the world. So right now it yields a dividend of about 2.5%. So if we add these different components together, we can get a picture of how we expect the business itself to actually perform. So how will earnings per share more or less look in a few years if we kind of project out? So right now you would be getting a 2.5% dividend yield. You'd probably get about 2.5% from share buybacks based on several years of history if they continue down this path. Now the organic earnings growth plus the earnings growth due to acquisitions, it's probably going to be, I would say, somewhere between the 5 and 10% range. I don't think it's going to be shoot the lights out growth. I think it's going to be okay, consistent with the past, maybe a little worse, but that may be buoyed a little bit by the growth of Aladdin, like I mentioned earlier. That's been a strong driver for them. And I think that even in a recession, even in periods where the industry itself is struggling, companies will need to invest in the latest software and the latest operating systems in order to maintain being up to date with their clients and, you know, just in order to be competitive. So I think they have a strong product offering there that could help grow earnings naturally. So you add those things together, I'm thinking between 10 and 15% business growth, which is really good. I mean, I do expect good things for Blackstone. See, I messed it up again. It's BlackRock. I do expect good things for BlackRock going forward. The problem is overvaluation. I think they really should trade somewhere around 15 times earnings, something like that, in order to be fair. So if you subtract the overvaluation and at this price point right now in early 2020, as I record this, I think the business will probably compound somewhere between 5 and 10% annually. I think you'll do okay buying BlackRock. I just think it'll take a really long time for you to get higher than low double digit returns, just because 20 times earnings is really, really high. Now, at the end of 2018, if you were to look at the stock price, it was significantly lower. And that's because the stock market was significantly lower. And as a financial company that manages a lot of equities, their assets under management was significantly affected by that stock market decline. So keep that in mind and pay attention to that. When you see a major market decline, look at the stock price of some of the larger financial companies. Look at BlackRock, look at Invesco, look at T. Rowe Price, look at Franklin Templeton Investments. How are their stock prices doing when the market falls? Because that can be an indicator to you of a potentially undervalued situation, just because you know that those two things are tied together. So keep that in mind. BlackRock has had exceptional historical performance. I mean, they've grown, I think their stock price alone has grown at 19% annually compounded since their IPO. I mean, they have been doing great for investors who invested in them in the early days. So they definitely have a track record. The growth has mainly been through acquisition, and they're already the biggest player in the industry. But then again, you could have said that in 2009, they were the biggest player in the industry in 2009, and yet they've returned significant returns since then too. So just because a company is massive doesn't mean it won't continue to keep growing, especially in an industry such as asset management, where scalability is much more viable than something like, say, a car company or something that's capital intensive. So one thing I don't like is that the industry is not that good for pricing power. Price increases are just not really a part of this business, at least not right now, because everyone is switching to lower cost investment services. And it depends on the economy of scale to keep clients invested. You know, if you're a smaller asset management company, you're going to struggle probably to keep clients in this environment, just because clients want asset managers who have everything that they want. And so there's this massive consolidation in the business. And yeah, so BlackRock is one of these bigger players. That's one of their advantages. But they don't necessarily don't have pricing power in the industry, because people will just switch, right? People will just switch to another firm. So that being said, BlackRock seems like a very solid company. I like it. It's very large, very complex. There's a lot of different products that they offer. I'm excited about their technology services revenue. I think there's an exciting opportunity there and an exciting story there. But at the same time, 20 times earnings for asset manager, I'm just not buying it. So that's my opinion, but I think it's a great company. All right, so that is the episode for today. Yeah, it feels good to go over another company again. Just getting 2020 going, and better believe I got more to come. So thank you for tuning in every single week to the Stock Stories podcast. And my name is Alex. I am your stock storyteller. If you want to get in touch with me, please feel free to reach out at alex@stockstoriespodcast.com or DM me on Instagram. Send me a direct message. Let me know what you think about the show. Let me know any questions you have. A few of you have been doing that, so thank you. My Instagram is @stockstoryteller. So direct message me there. All right. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back with another episode for you next week. Take care. The information presented here on Stock Stories is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. You and you alone are responsible for your investment and financial decisions. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, or financial advisor that can analyze your specific situation in the context of your goals and circumstances.